So welcome to Marcel in Action, everybody. Good evening. And as you can see, those of you who have been listening, we've been having our little technical challenges to get this thing fired up. This is Larry and Andy. Hi, Andy. Thank you. Thank you for being with us. Is everybody hearing me? Because we've been going back and forth with technical issues. Am I coming through loud and clear, Andy?
Yes, you are.
Okay, well, thank you. So we're going to try to make this work using TeamSpeak. There is some echo in the, so we may end up having to switch to the telephone system. But we're doing the best we can. So anyway, welcome to this to edition Narsal in Action on Wednesday night. My co-host is Andy from the Registry Matters podcast, who's assisting with production this evening and is responsible for making things run smoothly. During the first hour, we'll be discussing the deregistration process in the state of Colorado and the case of Millard versus Rankin, which is pending in the United States Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. Hour two will be, can they do that? We'll try to answer questions about whether a PO or registry tracking officer lawfully imposed requirements on you. There'll be a 5-minute break at the top of the hour, and you can stretch your legs and go to the bathroom or whatever. You'll hear some promotional messages run, and then you'll hear a news sounder that will tell you it's time to come back. And let me introduce you to our special guest, Colleen Kelly. Ms. Kelly is an associate at Wolf Law LLC, located in Denver. She's dedicated her practice entirely to criminal defense. And prior to entering private practice, Ms. Kelly was with the Colorado State Defender's Office. Ms. Kelly started as an intern with the Denver office after law school and spent the next 4 years practicing criminal defense in their Castle Rock office. While with a public defender, Ms. Kelly represented thousands of clients in county, and Colorado has what they call county court, which is the courts of limited jurisdiction, juvenile court, and district court, which is the general jurisdiction. And both rural and urban jurisdictions. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. And thank you for the shout out that you gave Narsal on your website and on Twitter. Welcome,
Colin. Thank you so much for having me.
There is so much echo here. I think I'm going to have to switch pretty soon. But glad you could be with us, and we're going to try to go through the questions as I have prepared them, and we try to make this efficient for the listeners so that they don't get bogged down with all the questions that they have trouble composing. So I've tried to imagine everything that you'll be interested in, and then we're going to try to take some questions from the audience. So let's begin by talking about deregistration in Colorado. Colorado revised statutes 16-22-113 permits a person to petition. Who is eligible, and how long must a person register before they can file this petition?
So in terms of how long a person has to register, it really varies according to the conviction, right, so the crime that they were convicted of. So there's certain eligibility requirements. So you have to first have an eligible conviction. You can only have one conviction involving unlawful sexual behavior to qualify at all. So even two separate convictions out of the same case can exclude a person from ever petitioning to deregister. And finally, you have to wait the specified time period for different classes of offenses. So in Colorado, we have classes of felonies that are numbered as well as misdemeanors. So a class 1, 2, or 3 felony, the person has to wait 20 years. A 4, 5, or 6 felony, they would have to wait 10 years. A class 1 misdemeanor, 10 years as well. Other misdemeanors, only 5 years. And when a person completes a deferred sentence or adjudication, they can petition right after successful completion when their case is dismissed. And also if they're under 18, when they're adjudicated, they can petition after a successful discharge of their sentence. There is another immediate section where if you were convicted of trafficking for sexual servitude and you can show that you were also being trafficked by another person, you can petition right after successful completion. But the thing that throws people off the most about this one is that these waiting periods start from the end of the person's sentence, meaning the date that they're discharged from the Department of Corrections, the Department of Human Services, or final release for the court's jurisdiction. So you have to finish the entire sentence before that waiting period even starts, including probation or parole, to start that time period running. So often people think it's going to be 10 years, but really they've been registering for more than that because they're registering during the probationary period.
Now, that is something I didn't even know. And so you got a situation where in Colorado where you have the indeterminate supervision, they might not get off after 10 years. So their period that they have to wait to petition is dependent upon when they get discharged from. So they got to go through that process first and get off of supervision. And then, is that correct?
That's correct. But a lot of people who are on that indeterminate supervision are also convicted of the crimes that are specifically excluded.
Okay, so they're already double whammed anyway. So multiple counts within the same case number. So if you have a second count, and even if it's the same case, that is an automatic exclusion from the petition. Okay. Are there any offenses that just cannot file for the petition that are excluded that are easy to summarize, or is that complicated?
No, that's pretty easy, because there's three main categories that will make a person just flat out ineligible to ever petition to deregister. So under Colorado, there's a sexually violent predator designation. So anyone designated in that manner is never going to be able to petition. Any person who has, as I said before, more than one conviction or adjudication, again, even in the same case, and then any person who's been convicted as an adult of a number of crimes. And those are sexual assault and some prior versions of our current sexual assault statute, sexual assault on a child, sexual assault on a child position of trust, sexual assault on a client by a psychotherapist, incest, and aggravated incest. So if you even have just one conviction for any of those charges, then you're never going to be able to eligible to deregister.
Wow, so we've narrowed down the universe considerably already tonight. Where would they file this petition? So they're living in Boulder, but they got convicted in La Plata County. Where would they file?
Sure. For Colorado convictions, it doesn't matter where the person is living. If they want to file it, they're going to file it into the court of conviction, and they're going to file it even under the original case number into the original criminal case. So that means if they're still around in the same courtroom, it's going to be the judge who sentenced that person. It's going to actually be the judge that would consider the petition as well.
So the person who has long gone on with their life and they've moved up to Boulder that got convicted down in La Plata County, they won't gain any advantage by living in Boulder because they were convicted in La Plata. They're going to file their petition in La Plata. And the judge, if that judge is still sitting in La Plata County, they're going to decide that petition, correct?
That's right.
Okay. What about a non-Colorado conviction? We would have feds, we would have out of state. We would have tribal land. Where do those convictions file at? If they're living in Colorado, but a Colorado court is not where the conviction arises from.
Yeah. So Colorado, I think, has similar rules on registration that other states have. That there's, if you have an out of state conviction or a federal or a military conviction, and you move here, there's two ways that you have to register. One of the ways is if you still have to register where that conviction came from, and the other one is even if you don't have to register in that other place, if the crime that you were convicted of would cause you to register under similar Colorado law, then you have to register here.
Where would that person file their petition when they think that they're eligible if they have a non-Colorado? Do they file it in the county where they're living, or do they have to file it back where they were convicted at?
Yeah, they have to file it. They have to file it in the county where they're living. Again, even if you don't have to register or if you've petitioned successfully in your home state, you still might be required to register in Colorado, and so you would have to still go through that deregistration process if you wanted to stop registering in Colorado. So you file that. That's obviously, there's no criminal case in Colorado to file it into like you would with a Colorado conviction. So what you have to do is you have to initiate a civil case in the county district court in the county in which you're living. And it's a little bit more complicated because you first have to make the case, that you're eligible to petition, right? And you can't just say, oh, I was convicted of this Colorado offense and it has been this time period, so therefore I'm eligible. You have to go through and make this comparison. So you have to take the statute that you're convicted under and start looking through Colorado laws and see what that conviction is going to be most similar to determine when or if you're eligible to petition. And this is one of those things where I think, you know, the judges will get it wrong and the DAs will get it wrong. And you really, you know, you want to find an attorney to do that really careful analysis, because that's the type that is going to get rejected most frequently, the one that's difficult to make that comparison.
But that one is where they actually get to do a little bit of forum shopping. They get to file that one where they're living. That civil proceeding, they get to file that in the county of where they're residing, since they don't have a Colorado case to attach to. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. And I've had some potential clients contact me on occasion and say, you know, I'm coming to Colorado. I think that I'm going to have to register, but I also think that I'm going to be eligible to petition to deregister under Colorado law, and I might agree with them. And they might, you know, I might recommend to them that maybe filing that application in Denver might be have a better chance of success than filing it in other jurisdictions.
Well, when they come to Colorado, say they've been registering in Florida for the requisite, let's take the longest period, 20 years, and they've been 20 years off paper, and they file it in Colorado. Does that 20 years count of the 20 years off paper, or do they need to start logging their time again in Colorado to get the requisite amount of time in? Is there any case law or any guidance on that?
There isn't. There isn't any specific rule about that, but the way that the Colorado law is written in general does allow for that reciprocity, essentially, right? So it basically says that, you know, if you would be eligible there, or I'm trying to figure out how to frame this answer specifically. Let's take it if Florida was, and you said 20 years, I guess I don't know how to frame the answer to that question.
I threw you a curve. That wasn't in the prepared, but I was thinking about it based on your previous answer, because the time starts from when they get off paper. So I'm taking the worst case scenario. Their person's been off paper for the longest period of time, and I'm wondering if that time counts. It would be awful if they come to Colorado and been on paper 20 years and it translates correctly, and then they say, well, you got to do your 20 years all over again here. That's what my state would say. So that was what made me think of that question. They would say, well,
no,
too bad. There's no reciprocity.
There's nothing about that, and there's no case law that says that that's the case, and there's nothing in the statute that said that you have to do that period in Colorado or you have to start that period over. And so the way the rest of the law is written, I would interpret it, and I think in general judges would agree with me that if you've been registering somewhere else for that period of time, that factors in just like you were registering in Colorado. I have a number of cases where my client has moved around, you know, and been in a number of states. And then when we file a petition to deregister here, the judge has honored, you know, that 20-year or 10-year registration requirement from the other states.
Okay, well, that's good to know. We're going to sharpen that a little bit here on the actual the steps in preparation for filing these petitions. Do you... Well, first of all, there are people out there wanting to know if they can do it themselves. Can a person do this without themselves? Or can they file a petition without themselves pro se? What's your opinion on that?
Well, can they? Yes. Should they? That's a different question. So these are fairly complicated statutes to follow. So I always recommend consulting with an attorney, and I think this is really particularly important when we're looking at those out-of-state filings where you have to make that statutory comparison. That's incredibly complex, and I don't think that a person without a law degree should be trying to do that themselves. Frequently, I get clients that have come to me after an attempt to file motion, you know, petitions like this pro se, and they've been denied. So again, there's nothing prohibiting it specifically, but the sad reality about these types of petitions is that judges tend to want to deny these, and they're going to be looking for procedural mistakes. You didn't file the notice. You didn't meet the time deadline. You didn't do this. So that they don't have to get to the point where they decide the case based on the merits. So again, interpreting the language of the law is difficult, even for attorneys. Getting all the requirements met is a challenge. And prior to filing a petition in Colorado, you have to send notifications of the intent. You have to send those notifications to the district attorney that obtained the original conviction. You have to send it to law enforcement agencies where you've been required to register, and the prosecuting attorney for jurisdictions where you've registered. And you have to file proof of those notices. And so, I mean, that's just the notification requirement. But you also want to make sure with these notification requirements that we know that the person has been in compliance. So I certainly don't want to be sending out a notice to North Carolina where the person has lived, where they thought they didn't have to register, and we're sending that out to them and they're looking at it and it tips them off that the person has been living there and has failed to register under their law. And that's happened to me before, where a client has done that exact same thing. And the DA here, when they get the notice, has tipped off the other state, and that person has ended up with a new filing of criminal charges. So you want to be really, really careful that you're not doing something that actually is going to harm yourself. And that's why you want to consult, I think, with an attorney on these. Again, that's just some of the issues with the filing process. And you still have to get through a hearing if the judge requires one, and they almost always do. Locating old files can be really important. Knowing where those are, what to get, and what the judges are looking for are really, really important. So a non-attorney filing this type of petition is going to be expected to adhere to all of the requirements and all the evidentiary rules that an attorney is going to be held to. So those are the concerns that I would have with someone filing it on their own.
Well, I'm gonna ad lib something here that before I go to the next question. In addition to that, you would want to have a conversation, I would assume, with the prosecutor to find out what their temperature level is on this person. And the person can't go in themselves and say, you know, I'm just kind of wondering how you feel about me these days. That happened 14 years ago. But the attorney can, Ms. Kelly or whoever can do that, and we can find out what the pulse is in that office, if it was a high-profile case in that particular community. If they're going to fight tooth and nail, if they've got some goodies that they might know about that person, they'd be much more likely to tell the attorney than they're going to say, oh, yeah, well, if you go in and say, I want to talk to you about my petition, that's just not going to work. Would that be a fair assessment?
Oh, sure. And one of the biggest things that I do when I'm filing these petitions is I make sure that I talk to the prosecutor that's going to be at the hearing, and I make sure I understand what their position is, if they're going to object, why they're going to object, and then I'm ready to counter that. So if they're going to object based on, I don't know, the victim's position, you know, maybe we reach out to the victim. Maybe we know something about the history that they don't know. Maybe something has happened since then that we can bring up that sort of sways their opinion on that. There's a number of ways that you can just be really persuasive with the prosecutor, and if the prosecutor is not objecting, then you have a much greater chance of the judge granting the petition.
Well, we've talked about some of the steps you've already illuminated here. What about a psychosexual eval? Assuming that you've cleared them through all the other hoops that you would go through and your check boxes before you went in to have the hearing, would you recommend that be a kind of a standard practice of having a current psychosexual, or is that necessary in Colorado?
Well, it can be helpful. So this is hard to answer out of the context of a particular case. One of the considerations is that those psychosexual evaluations are fairly costly. In Colorado, they're around $2,500.
Common, yeah, yes.
Same, right. So if you're well-financed, yes, go get an evaluation. See what it says. It's not going to hurt you unless it's a bad evaluation. So what you want to do is you want to be aware of who you're signing a release to see this completed evaluation. So, again, this is something that I think I discuss with my clients, whether this is something that's worth it and worth the money. You want to consider what result your past evaluations have yielded. If the past evaluation was recent and it was positive and you can locate a copy of it, then you may not want to chance another evaluation that's less positive, right, compared to the old ones. But a lot of times we can't locate copies of that prior evaluation, and those evaluations are usually done at the time of sentencing. So when we can't find one of those, that's when we're thinking about doing it. Because the judge and the prosecutor are looking for that professional opinion. They're looking for a finding that this person is not a risk of reoffending, is not a risk to the community going forward. And they're looking for someone else to make that decision. So a lot of times, if the evaluator is willing to make that finding, that's one of the great things that we can present to a judge to convince them to grant that.
Well, I'm going to get into some issues of cost now. When the petitions, each client is different, and each jurisdiction is different. If you're based in Denver and you're going to have to travel down to La Plata County, you're probably going to factor that. But can you give a ballpark of what the range of cost would be for a competent legal professional such as yourself, who's done these all over the state? What would they be looking at in terms of an average cost?
I think around $3,000 to $5,000is a reasonable cost, and obviously, the cost is going to vary based on the case, right? How complicated is the case? How much does the district attorney object? Is there going to be a hearing? Does the attorney need to travel? So a lot of times, you want to find an attorney that's local to where you're going to find it. But unfortunately, in some of the rural areas, there aren't a lot of attorneys that practice this specific type of law. And one of the things that I really highly, highly recommend is someone who understands the process and who has experience filing these types of petitions, again, to increase your chance of success.
Well, this question was sent to me, and it's, why do I have to spend all this money and go to court? My lawyer and the judge both told me I only had to register for a certain amount of time. Is this fair? I have to go spend $5,000 now, you're telling me? And they told me back when I did this I was going to have to register for 10 years. What's up with this?
Sure. And one of the things that people have to keep in mind is, well, there's a couple of things you have to keep in mind. Judges misinform people. District attorneys misinform people, even defense attorneys misinform their clients on occasion. And so, and then the other thing is sometimes people misunderstand what they're being told. When they're being told, if you register for 10 years, then you will be eligible to petition to deregister, what they hear is, oh, great, I only have to register for 10 years. So it's just not something that happens automatically, and it doesn't matter what the judge or what the DA or what your defense attorney at the time told you. It's really just dictated by the function of law. Sometimes people think they've been told by whomever that they only have to register for a certain period of time. For example, they would only have to register for the period of their probation. And that's just not what the law says. And there's certain other motions you can file at certain other times to withdraw your plea because you didn't understand it or because your attorney didn't properly advise you. But for the most part, you just have to go by what the law says.
So, I would like to know, okay, I paid my $5,000 and I've been granted a hearing. They show up in court. Who has to prove what? Who bears a burden of proving what? Does the state have to prove that I should stay on the register, or do I have to prove that I should get off?
Well,
or does anybody know?
there's no one knows. That's kind of the problem. So there's not, the statute doesn't specifically establish a burden of proof. And the burden of proof, right, is what someone has to prove in order to win. So the way that the Colorado statute is written is it just says the court may grant a petition if it finds that the person has completed their sentence, that they haven't been later convicted of another sex offense, and that they've waited the required period of time. So may grant certainly doesn't mean that the court has to grant something. And so the statute goes on to explain what the court should look at to determine whether or not to grant these types of petitions. And so what, under current law, the court is supposed to look at, or is the statute suggests the court looks at, is any treatment records that can be provided, right, meaning sex offense treatment or alcohol or drug treatment, any treatment records, any statements of the victim, and any other, quote, relevant information presented by the petitioner or the DA. And this is one of the issues that's addressed in a recent case in the United States District Court for District of Colorado, and that's the case that you mentioned in the introduction, Millard v. Rankin. And the judge in that case specifically addressed this as a huge problem with the Colorado statute, that it doesn't establish a burden of proof. And it doesn't even establish a standard for the court to apply in determining whether to grant that petition. The judges are confused. And I've had this conversation on the record in court where the judge says, well, the statute doesn't really give me much guidance as to what I have to consider, what I can consider, or who has to prove what. So that issue is really up in the air. It's a problem with the statute. My position on it is that we go in there trying to prove that this person should be off the registry by proving that there's no reason for them to be on there.
Well, that was pivotal in the Millard Rankin case, in terms of one plaintiff, I believe it was Vega. Didn't he file multiple petitions and to no good result? Do I have that right?
Right, yeah. So in that case, there's three plaintiffs, and Vega was adjudicated at the age of 15, so it was a juvenile case. And the acts that constitute the crime occurred when he was 13. So he pled guilty to a sexual assault, and he sentenced to probation at a juvenile treatment facility. His probation later gets revoked, and he served, I think, 2 years in the Department of Youth Corrections. And when he's in the Department of Youth Corrections, he was actually required as part of his sentence to participate in sex offender treatment. After he gets out of DYC, after he finishes his sentence, then, again, according to statute, where he's eligible at that point, when he's done with a juvenile sentence, he can petition to be registered. So he files a petition, and the first one gets denied. And he eventually files a second petition, and that one gets denied as well. And so the case really talks about that, and they focus on this issue pretty extensively, that for a juvenile petition, the statute only has two requirements. And the two requirements for a juvenile petition are successful completion of the sentence and no subsequent conviction. So it's really undisputed in the record that he had met those requirements. He had made that showing under the statute at those hearings. So it's undisputed that he had completed his sentence, and it's also undisputed that he hadn't committed any additional or later sexual offenses. And so again, it was this problem with the burden of proof. It only says what to consider. And under the juvenile statute, it actually says, also, the court shall consider whether the person is likely to commit a subsequent offense involving unlawful sexual behavior. So in support of that idea, right, Vega presents evidence that he's not going to reoffend, right? So he personally testifies that he attended and he completed his treatment as required. The problem, according to those magistrates that were overseeing these petition hearings, is that he didn't prove it. They wanted him to present documentation somehow that he had completed sex offender treatment. And at the second hearing, the magistrate even says something to the equivalent of, well, you're going to have to show me that you successfully completed this treatment and that you successfully completed your sentence. The problem is that all of his records, and again, this is undisputed, that all of the records from Department of Youth Corrections had already been destroyed. His own uncontradicted testimony, right, that he had completed sex offender treatment just wasn't good enough for this judge. So the problem that Judge Mache in the Millard case, the judge identifies is that both magistrates on both of these petitions held that somehow by failing to submit proof of completion of treatment, he hadn't met the requirements. And again, the problem is that they wanted him to fulfill this impossible requirement. The records had already been destroyed according to DYC's own policy. And so the focus, you know, in that case is how absurd that process is and how that procedure had deprived him of procedural due process.
So that was one of the prevailing issues in the case that's now before the Tenth Circuit we're going to talk about a little bit later. I'm going to try to accelerate the speed of the answers. What happens when a person is denied deregistration? Can they file another petition, and if so, when?
Sure. There's nothing prohibiting it. They can file it the next day. But, you know, you have to keep in mind that when you file another petition, it's going to go back to the exact same judge. So
you better have some new evidence.
Yeah, new evidence. Like, then you went back to treatment. So if it's procedural, your petition gets denied just because you haven't met the time requirement, then wait until the time requirement has passed and you can file another petition. If it's something more substantive, like in the Vega situation where the judge says, well, I want to see that you completed treatment or I want to see this or that, you know, consider whether you're going to just file an appeal, right, if the judge is violating your rights, or if you're going to go back and do something. Maybe it's find the victim and get the victim's opinion. Maybe it's bring in, you know, supporting letters from your friends or family. That's something that you want to talk to an attorney about, too, kind of what the best next act is.
We mentioned about forum shopping as a possibility for out-of-state non-Colorado convictions. That's not an option for people whose convictions occurred within the Colorado judicial system. When people come to you with these petitions, do you ever tell them, well, it's never happened in that jurisdiction? Are there jurisdictions, you said Denver might be more favorable if a person had that option, are there jurisdictions where they just are opposed adamantly and they just have not been granted in your experience?
Not that I'm aware of. I think that these always are factual determinations. You know, it's going to depend on the case. But certainly there's areas that are more, you know, the more populated urban areas are the ones used to seeing more of these petitions, where the rural areas are not. So I don't have statistics on this jurisdiction never grants them or this jurisdiction always grants them. I'll just say that the urban areas are more likely to see these, and I think that there's some more conservative areas of Colorado that are a little bit more reluctant to grant them. I think El Paso County, which is Colorado Springs, has been a challenge to convince the judge that these petitions should be granted.
So, well, I was thinking that myself, but I wanted to hear it from you. We would generally expect the urban areas. It's the same with rehabilitation and diversion programs. They tend to be a little more tolerant. If you picked up your charge down in Dove Creek, I would suspect they would be very hard nosed on everything there. We talked a little bit about.
I just wanted to add, the other factor that goes into that is my experience is that those rural areas, those small town types of situations, are also harder for people who are registered sex offenders to live in. Those are the small communities where people are ostracized, and so they end up living in bigger cities where they're not harassed as much. So that's a big factor as to why a lot of these petitions are not getting filed in those jurisdictions as well, as far as my experience goes.
Well, we're going to try to, I'm going to hope that we can use some of the time for can they do that and finish up with this issue of the primary part of the program. We got a late start. And then if you can't stay beyond the 2 hours, we can still do can we do that. We have a backup person. But on the Miller case, on the Tenth Circuit case, we talked about it earlier in terms of Plaintiff Vega, but there were two other plaintiffs. This is a very important case that NARSL has put resources in, and I didn't say in the intro, but I reached out to you, and you were very kind to help us in terms of understanding the registration, and you offered your services and your cell phone number to NARSL and to Professor Sullivan, who wrote our brief, and we appreciate that very much. But can you tell us what, to help the people understand why this case is important and what Judge Mache found in terms of the other two plaintiffs?
Sure. So just to be clear, this is a civil case that was filed in Colorado in the United States District Court for the District of Colorado. And the three similar plaintiffs, who are all sex offenders, were alleging that the Colorado Sex Offender Registration Act violated their rights under the 8th and 14th Amendments to the Constitution. And they asserted that the registration requirements, as they applied to them personally, violated the 8th Amendment prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment, and also that their due process rights were being violated. And in the end, the court, for the most part, agreed with them. So this case is incredibly important because the judge is really recognizing in the order in this case that sex offender registration is harmful to people in a lot of cases, and that it is punishment, and it has these incredibly devastating effects on them and on their loved ones and their friends and their families. So, again, the attorney that represented these plaintiffs, Allison Ruttenberg, did an amazing, amazing job getting enough of that evidence of harm in for the judge to be able to make that decision. And so the case is currently being appealed, and it's being appealed to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And the 10th Circuit, the jurisdiction of that court, covers six states. So Oklahoma, Kansas, New Mexico, Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and then there's some other smaller territories that it stretches into. And what people have to understand is that's the last appellate review of all the cases that are tried within these six states before it would go to the United States Supreme Court. So once the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals makes that ruling, it's going to control all of the courts in all of those states. And the only court that could later reverse a ruling would be the U.S. Supreme Court. So I think it's important to consider it where if this ruling stands, there's going to have to be a lot of rethinking by the state legislatures of how they're going to impose and how they're going to enforce their sex offender registration laws.
Well,
is there anything else you wanted me to comment on?
It was so important to us that we used a lot of our resources in terms of, and we do appreciate your help, as I stated, but we felt like that for so many people that live in the 10th Circuit that we couldn't let this case go unnoticed. And the fact of the matter is that Allison did do an amazing job. She had absolutely no money to work with. The plaintiffs had no resources. And she had an appointed judge who's what we call a senior judge, senior status, which is achieved by a combination of factors we don't need to get into, but he was appointed by President Nixon in the early 70s. And Judge Mache made a very courageous decision, and he only wanted to hear from the individuals. Didn't want to hear all that gibberish from experts. If this decision stands, and this is not in the prepared questions, but what do you think, based on the two denials of the cert petitions that were filed in the case in Pennsylvania and in the case out of Michigan, do you think that the state of Colorado would seek cert from the Supreme Court on this if they were to uphold Judge Page? It's just a guess.
I practice in Colorado right now, and, you know, knowing the Attorney General's office, yes, I think that would happen. I think that they're going to fight this to the end. But look, Colorado is not the only state that is fighting that. The focus of, you know, opposing sex offender registration, and not in its entirety, right? But there's been an argument that's been made for a number of years by plaintiffs or defendants and their attorneys that the registration is punitive, right? That it is punishment, and that's how it operates. And court after court after court has found, oh, this isn't punishment. It's not punitive. It's made to protect the public. So it's just a civil procedure. It doesn't punish people. And again, Judge Mache determined the opposite. I mean, and he really spoke the truth of what a lot of people who are subject to these laws, and again, their families, have been feeling, is that this is punishment. This ostracizes us. And this subjects us to harassment, and this makes it so we can't rent houses, and you know, it's the equivalent of banishment, essentially. And it's not good for society. So finally, you know, Judge Mache, I think, went further than any other ruling of finding that this really does operate as punishment, and it is punitive.
Well, it is an awesome decision. It's well written. And we're cautiously optimistic. I never want to be overly optimistic, but we're cautiously optimistic that we had our brief, and you had the chance to review our brief. We had the 17 professors, I believe that's what that group was, and I think both of the briefs were good. Did you get a chance to review both final products of ours and the 17 professors?
Yes.
Did you have any observations to make about the briefs?
Oh, I'm sorry, I lost you for a second. Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, the two briefs, the amicus parties, we had the professors and we had Darcel's brief, and I honestly didn't fully comprehend everything they had in the legal expert's brief. I did participate in the drafting of ours, but did you have any critique of the two briefs you'd like to offer?
Well, I think it's just supporting Judge makes his findings, right? His orders that these, when you compare the intent of the statute versus the effect that the statute is having, it ends up being this punitive sanction. So that's the part that I think is really, really important in the appeal of this case, is that is the part that needs to really be looked at. And again, the best part about this appeal is that the record was established so well with these people testifying, and the higher court will be able to see that record. They will be able to see the actual effects. And I don't think that those effects were necessarily part of the record in other cases, in other jurisdictions.
Well, Andy, we're going to have a little bit of a problem here, but I'd like to switch mode and go into to caller questions, which means we have to relocate everybody because we're not on bridge like we would be. So if I switch it, can you begin the process of finding everybody that needs to be reconnected? Because I can't even find myself. There's too many people on here.
Mm-hmm.
I have not located me yet, and I've been going back and forth trying to find myself.
I got it.
I I am calling from 505. Well, folks, what I'm going to do is I'm going to switch to from lecture mode to questions and answers, and you will be. We'll have to get ourselves back unmuted because it'll also suppress us. So as soon as we can get ourselves back, then we will start taking questions. So, Colleen, are you back?
I'm back.
Okay. Apologize for that. So anyone who has a question, press star 6. And what we're going to do is we're going to take, Colleen, I don't know, we planned for you for 2 hours, but we're going to take as many of the questions as we can for this, and then we're going to do, can we do that? Can they do that? And if you can stay for longer, we'll have you, and if not, I have a backup that's supposed to come in here shortly after our scheduled 2 hours, because I told him we might go long. I expected to be a lot of interest in this, so we're going to start taking questions. And folks, please keep your question focused, sharp, and to the point. We don't have time for you to tell a story because the queue is full of people right now. So I'm going to take the questions. I'm going to open your mic, and as soon as you finish your question, I'm going to suppress your mic. It'll say muted again, and if we need to come back to you, I'll open your mic again. But otherwise, we'll have barking dogs and freight trains and everything else. So I'm going to start in order they're in the queue. Area code 531, you're on Norsland Action. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Hank in Omaha. Ms. Kelly,
hi,
thank
Hank.
You very much. For, hi, how are you? Thank you very
great.
Much. Great. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Kelly, for visiting us. My question is this. I read on another site that a Colorado guy has been told by the DOC that he's a denier and that he may be able to get out and parole and bypass the mandatory treatment. It has to do with them not having enough money to open another jail, to keep Carson prison. Have you heard anything about that?
Sorry, I had a little bit of trouble hearing you, but what I think you're asking is if you are supposed to be receiving treatment in the Department of Corrections, that, and if they can't provide it to you, then they have to let you out?
He's a denier, which means he's not saying he's guilty because he's appealing. So
I think, Hank, what you're trying to ask is if they don't admit their underlying offense. Is that correct, Hank?
Yes.
They can't participate in treatment if they don't confess that they did it. And some people maintain their innocence all through the process.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, then I didn't hear that question properly at all. Yeah, that is what happens in Colorado. We try to prep our clients for that if they're thinking about entering a plea. And it's a little bit difficult because even if someone does admit to something, it's not always the exact thing that the victim had reported. So it does cause a lot of problems. They expect in Colorado sex offender treatment for you to admit the circumstances as reported by the victim. And you can be kicked out of treatment, and obviously that is a violation of any release conditions.
Does that clarify for you, Hank, or do you need more?
I think it's okay. So what I'm hearing is that it is he can get on probation, get out on parole without doing the treatment program.
Well, no, I mean, for a sex offense, you're always going to be ordered to complete sex offender treatment.
So what Hank was saying was, I guess they're not releasing people as well. They're going to require you to get treatment. It's an industry, but was your question, Hank, that they have to admit before they get on parole as a condition for being granted parole? Was that, did I screw up your question?
Yeah, that was it. Do they have to go to admit? Because you have to, if you go through treatment, you have to admit.
But to get to be released on parole, do they have to admit? And then we're gonna go to a break shortly after when the music starts playing. But is that your
okay.
question, Hank?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. So must a person admit their crime before they're released on parole in Colorado?
Well, yes, because they have to be in compliance with the treatment requirements, and the treatment requirements are admitting. So, short answer, yeah, absolutely. You're not getting paroled until you make an admission.
Okay. So, Mr. Producer, do we have any more time, or are we going to take a break now?
About 10 seconds is when I'm going to start it, so we may as well just start.
Okay.
Now.
Okay, so, well, what we're going to do, folks, we're going to take a five-minute break here, and you're going to hear some messages. And the person that I put on from 719 that didn't hear me, put yourself back in the queue, and we'll take you back again. Apologize for that. I don't know if it was our problem or yours. But we're going to come back, and we're going to do additional questions. And if you would like to ask a question, hit star 6 on your telephone. and we will be back on the flip side to take as many questions as we can for Ms. Kelly. So you are listening to NARSL in Action.